President Trump's nominee for chief scientist at the Department of Agriculture isn't a scientist. And he's also not convinced about the science of climate change.
I think a lot of what we see is junk science. It's not proven. So I'm a skeptic.
I'm Carol Holzapfel. This week on the Allegheny Front, do you have to be a scientist to hold a top science position? An actual scientist weighs in. Plus, a new art exhibit asks whether our region will see the same environmental problems and health impacts as Louisiana when the petrochemical industry comes to town.
I would hope not, but it looks like we're going down that path, and this is kind of a warning call.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Former White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer was in Pittsburgh Thursday, touting his former employer's record on jobs. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports Spicer thinks rollbacks of regulations have boosted the economy.
Sean Spicer was speaking at a gas industry conference whose keynote speaker last year was then-presidential candidate Donald Trump. Spicer told this year's conference that Trump's dozens of moves to roll back Obama-era regulations on industries like theirs was having a positive effect on the economy. Spicer pointed to a report from the Commerce Department that says second quarter growth in the economy was at 3.1%, the highest rate in 2 years.
It's not that the government did it, it's that you did it. If we can get government out of the way in a smart way, industries like yours make smart investment, uses innovative technologies that bring back, say, the manufacturing sector, put more people to work at good jobs.
Spicer told the crowd Trump's moves to boost production weren't just good for the economy, but also foreign policy.
By Poland buying our natural gas, it's a check on Russia. If you are concerned about the Russian influence overseas, suddenly now you have Poland and other places throughout that region buying U.S. gas.
Spicer said it was an honor working as White House press secretary and that he was eternally grateful to President Trump for the opportunity. In other remarks, Spicer says when he first began his job for the new administration, he wasn't quite as prepared as he'd wished he'd been. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
Two northeastern Pennsylvania families who claimed natural gas development polluted their water supplies have settled with a drilling company. A State Impact Pennsylvania's Katie Culinary reports it's the final chapter of a long legal battle in the Susquehanna County village of Dimmock, which became the poster child for the risks of fracking.
The settlement comes 6 months after a judge reversed a jury's verdict, ordering Cabot Oil and Gas to pay $4.2 million for contaminating two Dimmock families' water wells. At the time, the judge said there wasn't enough evidence to prove Cabot was responsible and asked the parties to try to reach a settlement. A lawyer for the families declined to comment on the terms of the agreement, but says her clients are relieved to put the matter behind them. One of the families, the Elys, was featured in the documentary Gasland. It put Dimmock's troubles with gas drilling in the international spotlight and helped touch off the American anti-fracking movement. Filmmaker Josh Fox says he's kept in touch with the Elys.
They didn't care about money. They wanted justice, and they got justice. I think they showed the world that this process is extraordinarily destructive to the environment.
Other Dimmock families settled with the gas company back in 2012. Cabot has maintained it did nothing wrong. In a statement, a spokesman said, quote, the matter is now closed. Katie Culinary, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Later on the Allegheny Front, a new art exhibit further explores the impact of natural gas development in our region. The show looks at the petrochemical industry in Louisiana and health concerns over the upcoming ethane cracker in Beaver County. But that's later. Right now, let's turn our attention to the struggle over Pennsylvania's budget. Because State House representatives have proposed transferring hundreds of millions of dollars from special funds, including those that fuel projects like parks, recycling, and industrial cleanups, to balance the budget, rather than raise taxes or levy a severance tax on the natural gas industry. Here to talk with me about this and how a federal bill could accelerate mine cleanup in Pennsylvania is John Dawes, Executive Director of the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. John, where is this effort by state House representatives now?
It is actually between the House and Senate, and I think that they are very much back to square one, because it's a terrible idea to illegally raid those funds. Those funds were collected, in the case of the Growing Greener Fund, related to the tipping fee, and they were collected for a specific purpose, and that was for environmental restoration. I would contend that should they be successful in doing so, that it will be litigated.
You mentioned Growing Greener. That's just one of the funds that that they're looking at drawing from. Can you say a little bit more about what Growing Greener is and how it's funded and what it does?
Well, Growing Greener was established by Governor Tom Ridge in the 90s. Growing Greener 2 was established by Governor Rendell. It's very much a bipartisan program and has meant wonderful restoration of our parks, of toxic pollution, of acid mine drainage throughout our communities. It has meant trails. It has meant wonderful recreation value to citizens of the state.
And the money for that fund doesn't come from taxpayers, right?
No, it comes from the tipping fee when out-of-state trash is imported to Pennsylvania and put in Pennsylvania landfills. A fee is paid, and it accumulates the Growing Greener Fund.
There are other funds that are eligible for this transfer, highway beautification, underground storage tank, indemnification fund. There are a number of funds. Can you give an example of some other environmental funds that might be drawn from and how they're used now?
Keystone is another, which is funded through a real estate transfer tax, and that has been traditionally used for accumulating land and adding lands to Pennsylvania state's forest and parks, and is tremendously valuable to watersheds for the reason that a healthy, clean environment is the source of our clean water.
Supporters of this House plan say it only touches surpluses in those funds. Is that accurate?
It's not, because most of those funds are obligated already in terms of projects that have been presented, that have been approved, are in some stage of completion. And the analysis that I've seen that was done by the Renew Growing Greener Coalition indicates that only $1.5 million from both funds would be available to balance a multi-billion dollar deficit. In my opinion, the biggest problem is the unwillingness of the House to enact a 5% severance tax on the gas industry.
How do you think this is likely to play out?
Right now, I don't know that the contention is between parties. One would think that it was between Democrats and Republicans. But in this instance, I believe it's between Senate leadership and leadership in the House of Representatives.
Well, on the federal level, I know you and others are working on something called the Reclaim Act of 2017, which was introduced in Congress, I believe, earlier this year. And it would release money from the Abandoned Mine Land Reclamation Fund. That's over 5 years to clean up abandoned coal mining sites in Appalachia and, of course, in Pennsylvania. What's happening with that effort to get it signed into law?
Well, it is moving forward. Reclaim, you know, it's an acronym. It's for revitalizing the economy of coal communities by leveraging local activities and investing more. Thus, Reclaim. And it's a very, very good bill, especially for Pennsylvania. As you stated earlier, the idea is to spend money out early from the Abandoned Mine Lands Fund, which has over $2 billion in it. The idea is to take $1 billion and spend $200 million a year for each of 5 years. For Pennsylvania, that would mean an additional $55 million a year for mine reclamation. And abandoned mine lands, as a reminder, and acid mine drainage are still the number one water quality problem in the state of Pennsylvania.
Those are those orange streams and that a lot of us who live in this region are familiar with.
Correct. That's exactly right. Part of the conditions of this early spend out is a requirement for job creation and for documenting that aspect of the reclamation work.
Right, and part of the reasoning behind it is to clean up these areas so they can be used for economic development.
Exactly. And our best example of that as a foundation, and we made a grant toward this, is the Ehrenfeld Project in Cambria County. And this is a place, a town, where 3.2 million tons of coal refuse that sit there, putting the town in a shadow, creating horrible environmental conditions, horrible water quality conditions, and making it such that nobody could sell their house in that town. You know, there's no real estate value. And it's more than $20 million where that pile is being removed right now. The township wants to do a park. So it's a great visible example, a very dramatic example of how these funds can improve an entire community.
Thank you so much for talking with me.
All right. Thank you.
John Dawes is executive director of the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, which has funded the Allegheny Front in the past. There's more at AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. What rhymes with turtle and will one day be produced by the burgeoning petrochemical industry in our region?
Nurdle is N-U-R-D-L-E. And nurdles are very small plastic pellets that serve as the raw material for the manufacture of plastic.
Later on the Allegheny Front, get to know your nurdles at a new art exhibit about how the petrochemical industry could impact the health and environment of Western Pennsylvania. Well, they're harder than I thought they were going to be. Stay tuned. It's no secret that the Trump administration has been at odds with scientists, and in particular, environmental science. President Trump's recent agency nominations continue to reflect that.
I think a lot of what we see is junk science. It's not proven. I don't think that there's any substantive information available to me that doesn't raise as many questions as it does answers. So I'm a skeptic.
That's Sam Clovis, Trump's pick for chief scientist at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. He was responding to a question from Iowa Public Radio about whether he believed in the science of climate change.
I have looked at the science, and I have enough of a science background to know when I'm being boofed.
Not quite sure what he means by that, but Clovis has been many things. Air Force fighter pilot, conservative talk show host, defeated U.S. Senate candidate. One thing he's not is a scientist. He holds a doctorate in public administration, but it's not science-related. Clovis's confirmation hearing hasn't been scheduled yet. But if confirmed, he would oversee USDA's $3 billion research budget, which funds, among other things, research to help farmers and ranchers adapt to climate change. In the latest episode of our podcast, Trump on Earth, the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant spoke by Skype with Mike Lavender of the Union of Concerned Scientists. Lavender focuses on food and environmental issues, and he's written about his many concerns about Clovis's nomination.
Sam Clovis has been nominated to be the chief scientist at the Department of Agriculture. So that's someone who invests taxpayer money in research into food safety and nutrition and clean water. But they're also monitoring scientific integrity at the Department of Agriculture. So it's a key position that is often behind the scenes and doesn't get much attention. But it really goes to investing taxpayer money into things that can keep our food safe, that can keep farmers productive and profitable, and that can keep our water clean. So having someone in that position who has a strong scientific background, who can make the right investments and the right decisions, is really important for everyday life. The position is so important that Congress actually emphasized and set a very high level of standards for this individual, requiring that they have significant experience and training. And unfortunately, Sam Clovis doesn't meet any of those qualifications, and so we feel he would be detrimental.
Is there anything that, you know, you're particularly worried about if there is not a scientist in this role in terms of food safety and water quality, things that would be impacted by this decisions made by the person in this position?
We're certainly worried about the water quality and certainly worried about food safety. But another key component of this role is maintaining scientific integrity, right? So that means things like making sure that when scientists do research, when they gather the facts and data, that they can present those without them being altered for political or other reasons. So protecting scientists and allowing them to share the facts, that is a key role at USDA. And if we don't have someone as the chief scientist of the Department of Agriculture who can protect scientists and allow them to share the facts and the data as they are without alteration, that puts all Americans in a difficult position because we're not investing based on the correct science and the correct data. So someone with a scientific background in that role is incredibly important because they understand the needs of scientific integrity and the importance of it. But certainly that's not to set aside the need to protect clean water and the need to really make the investments in farmers and ranchers. Hundreds of millions of acres of American land are farmed and ranched by people of this country. And so giving them the tools and the information they need to not only have a livelihood for them and their families and their communities, but to do so in a responsible way for the environment, that's what this role does.
Yeah, and I know that we are focused on the Department of Agriculture, but I want to get to kind of the bigger idea behind this in terms of the use of science or the idea of science and how it is being used within this administration. So over at the Environmental Protection Agency, where we've seen some scientists leaving, the administrator, Scott Pruitt, has talked about kind of a new idea for science.
Yeah, so the red team, blue team approach, it is something that puts people, experts in a room and let them debate an issue. I mean, with this climate change, we know certain things. We know the climate's always changing. We know that humans contribute to it in some way. To what degree, to measure that with precision is very difficult. But let's have a debate about that. Bring scientists in, red team scientists, blue team scientists, have a discussion.
Who are the red team scientists?
The red team scientists are the ones that don't take for granted that you see across the spectrum that the climate is just in this unsustainable path of existential threat and that humans are 99% responsible for that.
Is that a thing? Is there such a thing as a red or blue science, meaning a conservative or liberal science?
This idea of red team and blue team, it doesn't make sense because that trivializes the fact that it's impacting all Americans. And this isn't necessarily specific to agriculture, but when we talk to farmers, when we talk to people who are out there working the land every day, it's not a question to them that they're experiencing hotter summers or more rain or warmer winters, which can affect what they do on their property. This isn't a question. It's happening out there. And it is not a partisan thing. Farmers and their families and their communities are dealing with these things, whether it be floods or droughts. And so when you step outside of the political spectrum of the red team and the blue team, you know, there is an overwhelming consensus on climate change. And so we need individuals within the government to see that as a fact, because that's what it is.
Before this administration, would you say science was thought of as a political endeavor? I mean, I guess I wonder, like, why are we talking about red and blue science? Is that something that could be useful? Is that something that could work in any way?
From my standpoint, no. I think that adds a layer to scientific fact, to scientific reason, to the most basic principles of what science is. I think it's a layer that has certainly been new to this administration. Look, we've seen a lot of new things in this administration. We've seen scientists and researchers not being allowed to attend conferences. We've seen gag orders to one degree or another placed on individuals at certain agencies. And we've seen a number of other actions, probably most prominently, which is leaving many key science positions completely vacant. Over at the Department of Agriculture, for example, the only position that's been confirmed there is the secretary, the top position at the department. And so all these other important positions, many of the people who do a lot of the day-to-day work are vacant. And so that is one of the most startling things over the first several months of this administration that we've seen is really in terms of lack of respect for science and lack of a role of science in this administration. So it does feel very much different than previous administrations. And that's why we are trying to protect some of these key positions and make sure that qualified people fill those roles.
Yeah, I mean, what does that mean for policy when you, and I think you answered this in our discussion about Sam Clovis, but what does it mean when you have people, say, at the EPA or at USDA in scientific roles that don't have scientific backgrounds?
Well, I think when you have fewer science roles filled, what that means is that there are fewer people in the room when decisions are being made or fewer voices in the room. I think what we're seeing now is that in many cases, there are more political people in the room than science voices. Now, that's a blanket statement, and there's certainly differences throughout the federal government. But when you have more political voices, and in some cases only political voices, speaking up when there's a need for science and a need for science-based governance, that's a problem because there are so many questions, again, whether it's water quality, whether it's clean air. Those are things that need to be driven by science. We're not going to get cleaner air. We're not going to get cleaner water. We're not going to get safer food by making calculations that are other than science-based. Science is the accumulation of facts and data that we know to be true, observations and measurements. And that's what it is at its core. And so to portray it as something else than that is, you know, a terrible precedent to set.
Mike Lavender is with the Union of Concerned Scientists, where he focuses on food and environmental issues. He spoke with the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant by Skype for our Trump on Earth podcast. There's more at trumponearth.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Trump on Earth is a co-production with Point Park University's Environmental Journalism Program. That's trumponearth.org. What do Louisiana and Western Pennsylvania have in common? An industry that, for better or worse, inspires art. Petrochemical America, from Cancer Alley to Toxic Valley, is a new exhibit in Pittsburgh that takes a closer look at the petrochemical industry, which turns natural gas into the building blocks of plastic.
Cancer Alley is a stretch of the Mississippi River between Baton Rouge and New Orleans that is home to 150 different petrochemical plants and processing units. The cancer rates in this area are higher than almost anywhere else in the U.S. There is a lot of research there that draws on the relationship between these plants and the health impacts seen by people living there.
Sophie Rydell is the curator, and I caught up with her in the gallery as the show was still being put together. She says the pieces here represent the relationship between the industry in Louisiana's Gulf Coast and the ethane cracker that Royal Dutch Shell is building in Beaver County along the Ohio River.
That's where the Toxic Valley comes in. We're either in or will be in a Toxic Valley?
Yeah, I would hope not, but it looks like we're going down that path, and this is kind of a warning call.
A report that came out earlier this year estimated that Pennsylvania could support several more petrochemical plants, in addition to the one that Shell already has planned. That's what Rydell's afraid of. She points out the region already suffers from some of the dirtiest air in the country.
We're adding on layers of risk here.
We look at a piece called From the Earth to the Sky. Rydell says it's an ecological atlas by landscape architect Kate Orff. It's thumbtacked to the gallery wall and depicts a parade of ghostly figures in earthy tones, from Tyrannosaurus to modern humans.
It shows a geological timeline from prehistoric dinosaurs pressing down on layers of algae and creating this deep sediment layer that built it up into what we now call fossil fuels. And this map runs through that timeline and shows that, you know, we have this stark contrast with the age of oil, the period that we're in now, where the logic of Earth is kind of shattered and it just breaks off.
There's kind of a divide on the landscape, and then they look like thousands of little needles. What do those represent?
Disruptions to this logic of how the Earth maintains itself and how it evolves. Those are representative of deep water drilling, seafloor pipelines, and offshore drilling that's very common in the Gulf of Louisiana.
This piece and others by Orff are in conversation throughout the exhibit with photographs of the people and places impacted by Marcellus shale gas development in our region. What else do you want to show me?
Here we're looking at two touchscreens. We have collaborated with the CREATE Lab at Carnegie Mellon University. This is a tool for people to use at the gallery where they can study the patterns of point source emissions from these different chemical facilities. So we've used toxic release inventory data to map the plume from each company. You can zoom in, zoom out, toggle on a layer that shows which releases contain carcinogenic elements. This will show up in red. If you compare the distribution of plants in Louisiana with what's in our area, you'll see that we're actually far less burdened than they are by this type of development. I think we tend to normalize industrial pollution in our area and our manufacturing past. And to be honest, this map most likely underplays the effect of these industries. The toxic release inventory data is collected by the EPA, but it's self-reported by industries. So there's no real way to know exactly how much is released. The releases to the air, the releases to water, soil, all compounded into this like angry, blistering pattern of plants.
Yeah, they do look like rashes.
You don't want them.
Oh, this is a, it's a container of fluffy white balls, and the sign says nurdle.
That's right. This is a bowl of nurdles. Nurdle is N-U-R-D-L-E. And nurdles are very small plastic pellets that serve as the raw material for the manufacture of plastics. And this is what will be coming out of one of the petrochemical developments in Beaver County. This makes the ethylene less reactive or volatile for shipping, so that's a good thing.
Ethylene is cracked ethane gas. Ethane comes out of the ground along with methane, the main ingredient in natural gas, when a well is fracked.
Furnaces heat up the ethane molecules at very high temperature and it starts to wiggle and break down into separate parts. And one of the products of that transformation is ethylene, which can be used in products ranging from fertilizers, medicines, soaps, to plastics with polyethylene, which you bond them together and make them less reactive. We'd like to divorce plastics from the manufacturing of it. It comes as a nice Barbie doll. It comes as a part on a windshield wiper. It's ubiquitous. We know that. And it can seem less harmful than I think it really is.
This is a hand-on exhibit. Well, they're harder than I thought they were going to be.
They're not quite fluffy. No.
Why are you doing this exhibit now?
This exhibit is a timely response to the way that we've developed the natural gas infrastructure in our state. We're setting down in stone a supposedly transitional bridge fuel into this manufacturing system. This is a big move that I don't think all of us realize is going on, and the hope of this exhibit is to broaden the public discourse on the relationship between unconventional natural gas drilling and the downstream derivatives of plastics manufacturing and petrochemical developments.
Sophie Rydell is the curator of Petrochemical America, From Cancer Alley to Toxic Valley, which is now up at Space, a gallery in downtown Pittsburgh. The multimedia exhibit moves to Beaver County in mid-October. There's more, including a peek at some of the pieces, like nurdles, at AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for listening to The Allegheny Front. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show and podcast, Trump on Earth. That's TrumpOnEarth.org. I'm Carol Holzapfel.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration between public radio stations WITF in Harrisburg and WHYY in Philadelphia, covering the Commonwealth's energy economy.